Father Nielsen's presentation today, born from his vast experience ministering to college students during the past 15 years, is entitled, Healing the Psychological Trauma of Today's Elite College Students. I will now, with pleasure, turn the podium over to Father Eric Nielsen.
Thank you, Krishna. It's very it's a pleasure to be here speaking to you. I think, first of all, you should know, what do I know and what don't I know? I have a lot of intellectual understanding in theology, and I have pastoral experience. So that's what I know. So I'm not a psychologist, and I'm not an economist, and I don't do a lot of studies and things like that. So I'm not going to be an expert on those type of things. And so, but anyway, I kind of use a little of that in my talk, for better or for worse. You can correct me afterwards if you want to, on my poor use of information gained from the internet. And as you all know, at least what I do is we tend to retain information that we hear that agrees with our worldview and forget the stuff that doesn't. So my talk is pretty much threefold. What is the problem? Why does it exist? And how to solve it. I mean, is there a problem? You know, that's what we kind of want to know. Is there a problem? So let's see if I can get this thing to work here. I'm going to need Frank to come out here and show me how this, to get the slides to go down.
I think this will forward.
All right, there we go. All right, according to this, the suicide rate among young adults ages 15 to 24, which is the group that I'm working with there, 19 to 24, has tripled since 1950s. It's currently the second most common cause of death amongst college students. So today's talk about anxiety, but anxiety is, you know, it's hard to measure anxiety, but you can measure suicide pretty regularly. Right? It just shows up. And anxiety leads to depression, and depression leads to suicide. Percentage of United States college students with suicidal or self-injurious behavior in 2021, 23%. So almost one of every four college students has done something self-injurious in 2021. 13% have thought about suicide, and 1% have committed suicide. Suicide rate among young college students has tripled. That's the bar there of percentage of students that have injured themselves on the right. That's almost 20, one out of every four. The bar on the left is the students who thought about suicide in the last year, 13%. Those are the top 20 schools in the U.S. with the most depressed student bodies. Number 20, University of Wisconsin-Madison. 60% of all students have experienced overwhelming anxiety. I mean, how many of you over 60 have ever had overwhelming anxiety? To be overwhelmed with anxiety, 60%. At the University of Wisconsin-Madison, 21% of students are screened positively for depression. Almost 10% out of one every 10 students thought of suicide. All right, so why is this? When you look at our God is a trinity of persons, a Father, Son, and Holy Spirit living in relationship with each other in loving relationship. We are created to live in loving relationship with each other. That's primary. And we're created in the image and likeness of God. So part of the, and traditionally we think about that as our intellect and will, and that's true. But I would say part of the way we image God is that we're capable of living in a loving relationship with another person, all right? And we've messed up love in our culture. There's a way you love chocolate, right? And there is the way, in a sense, you love your boyfriend. But you love your boyfriend the way you should love your boyfriend? No, you love your boyfriend the way you love chocolate. It's a need that I have. I desire a boyfriend. Is there something wrong with that? No. I had a young girl I'm going to tell you a lot of stories that are going to make my tongue lock. So the girl's in my office the other day. Father, I just want to get married so bad, but I feel bad because I should just love Jesus and that should be enough for me. And I'm looking at this beautiful 21-year-old woman who just wants to get married and have a baby. And I tell her, I said, look, you know, I haven't had a glass of water in 4 days, but I really want a glass of water, but Jesus should be enough for me. I mean, if you really want a glass of water, you really want a glass of water. And if you really want to have a baby and a boyfriend, you really want to have a baby and boyfriend. There's nothing wrong with that. To desire a man and have, that's nothing wrong. But when the thing is, you can love the man the way you love a glass of water, and that's fine. But real love is to love that man for who that man is as a person, independent of what he can do for you. You know, that's what love is, to love another person for who that person is. And you'll know you love him when he goes out with you, that beautiful, tall, blue-eyed, dark-haired man, and who's self-employed for 10 hours a week, making $200,000 a year. And you'll know you love him when after a year you look at him and say, look, I love you so much, I realize you really should marry my sister. She's better for you. You know, that would be authentic love, okay? So we live in community. We're meant to live in community. And our communities, as we know, are falling apart. So when we look at the word community and we look at the word communion, it comes from the Latin word communis. Munis means gift. Communis means sharing the same gift. And when you share something together, it brings you together in community. And I think that is why God gave us food. Because you come together around a table and you all eat the same thing. And so I put this family up here, all eating out of the same pot. Which is really, you should do that with your family someday. Just put a stew in the middle of the table and just with bread and just start dipping it out and eating it, all right? So here's the one, I came across this idea on the internet and I liked it so much I researched it and I actually shelled out the $20 to get the Harvard study and download it. And so this is pretty, so, this graph, on the far left, you see that like the dark column and then the dark shaded column. And then you see the lighter column, the lighter columns. So the darker ones are, the black one is eternalizing problems. The dark checkered one is externalizing problems. Then the bottom one is positive well-being, pro-social behavior, and life satisfaction. And this is a Canadian study of 26,000 adolescents. And they found, yes?
What is pro-social behavior?
Pro-social behavior? You would have to read the study. I told you my scientific understanding is very limited. Keep your questions on the theology aspects. You can get it. Anyway, actually, I downloaded the whole thing on PDF. If you email me, I'll send it to you. All right. But what they found is the primary indicator of the well-being of adolescents is how many times they had dinner together as a family during the week. With, as you can see, 7 days a week statistically better than 6 days a week. Now, there's, as you all of you realize, there's a whole nexus of things that go along with having a family dinner every day. You know, the father's probably present, the mother's present. You know, there's a certain kind of social bonding that's in the family. You know, to make, so it's not just having dinner every day, but all the things that go together and having dinner every week together as a family. And just interestingly enough, my aunt and uncle are here, my brother's, my dad's sister. So I gotta be careful here. I don't want this to get back to my family too much. But we grew up eating together every day as a family. There were six of us. And we all sat in strategic places. Mom at one of the table, dad at the other. I was the oldest, so I was in the middle. You know, mom had the baby, dad had the one that was just older than the baby. You know, we all sat in these strategic spots, and as we grew up, we just stayed in the same spots. And interestingly enough, I find myself most emotionally attached to the two siblings that sat on either side of me during that dinner table. Maybe that's just coincidence, you know, but maybe there's something to that. That's the people that I shared this meal with every day, you know, for many years. So what happens to these students? This is the difficulty right now. And just to use my own example, it's great to grow up in a really small house. You know, we had six kids in pretty much a two-bedroom house. We had one bathroom with no shower. We moved out of it when I was 14, but it was a small little house. And, you know, we're always together. My dad was a blue-collar guy. When your dad's a blue-collar guy and you're, you know, the odds of you doing your dad better than your dad are pretty good, right? You know, if your dad's making $3 million a year, you're thinking, man, can I do that? You know, and so I remember going to college, and I met my dad at the door on my way to college. And my dad looks at me, he goes, Eric, where are you going with that backpack on? I said, Dad, I'm going to college. I'm hitchhiking down to Madison, starting engineering school down there. He says, oh, yeah, your ma said something about that. Do you need any money? I said, yeah, Dad, as much as you got. You know, and he gave me, he opened up his wallet at a 20 and there and a 10. He gave me the 20. And so went to school, right? And, you know, back in the day, you could do that. I went down, you know, tuition was $400 at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You know, I worked my way through college, but it wasn't that hard because tuition was only $400, right? And so nowadays, you think about it, freshman year, this freshman girl, you got to go to college. You're smart. You got to achieve. And you come home from school and your mom puts the report card on the refrigerator. And everybody loves you because you're so smart. Now, everybody loves you for who you are, but in the back of your mind, you're thinking, you know, you're getting all this feedback for how smart you are and how much potential you have. And suddenly you think, I got to live up to this potential. And so I got to get into this really good college. And so you go to a really good high school. And everybody there in that high school is super achieving. Here's an interesting. They did a big study in the 9 high achieving high schools in the Northeast. These are high schools. U.S. depression and anxiety are 6 to 7 times the natural average. Because you have all these really intelligent kids from affluent families just competing with each other. You know, they're not really forming relaxed friendships as much as they're competitors, you know, for the college they want to get into. So this young girl then, after she finally gets into a big college, she gets there, school is hard. She loves the school, but it's difficult, and she's already a little stressed out, and she gets her first report card. Here's interesting. Percentage of score for depression in relation to GPA, and it's just, you know, you go to a good school, and if your grades aren't good, and you're supposed to be the smart kid, and you're not achieving as much as you want to, and at a college, like the University of Wisconsin-Madison, you know, it filters down from the university professors. Your worth is based on how smart you are. And if you're not that smart, your worth starts to be devalued. So then you call your mother. For children facing various adversities, the single most important factor in fostering resilience is having a good relationship with the primary caregiver, usually the mother, which in turn rests on the parent's psychological health, right? So she's stressed, she calls her mom. Maybe her mom isn't psychologically healthy because she doesn't have a good relationship with her husband and things are going on. And I had an argument with my mother. And I'm like, well, you know, that's human nature to have an argument with your mother. It's not a sin to argue. Do you, you know, give her the finger or something? You know, what did you do during the argument? And well, I want to go to the Rose Bowl, and she says no. I'm like, well, why argue? Just go, you know. You know, how old are you? You know, 22. Well, you know, you're a free woman. And is your mom paying for everything that you do in college? Oh, yes, she is. Well, then I guess you can't go to the Rose Bowl then, you know. Maybe you might want to have a conversation with her about, you know, what are the conditions for you having that money? You know, just like a banker, you know, when you go to a bank for money, they give you conditions for having the money. And then the banker, then you can do it, because I had to do that when I built the building. You know, I had to borrow $12 million. These are the conditions for the $12 million. So long as I met those conditions, I could do whatever I wanted with the $12 million. So that's what you want to do when your parents give you money. Find out what the conditions are, and you're free to do what else you want with that, right? So these young girls then are stressed out, and they go to their mom. They get more stressed out by talking to their mom because they get a big argument with their mom. So then they go to their peers. But that's difficult because they're not used to having friends anymore. They have friends on social media. They have friends through texting. And so they're not really friends. They really don't know how to intercommunicate with each other. So then, instead of going to her friends, she finds something even better than a mom or friends. She finds a boyfriend. And that's like a drug that enters into her soul that alleviates all pain, right? A boyfriend is kind of like you have a bad knee joint and somebody just shot you up with Novocaine. Your knee feels fine. And that's the way it is with a boyfriend. And here's the trouble. I don't know if you can read this. So, this is your typical male-female relationship. The girl is thinking, we'll get engaged in grad school, married when I start my PhD, and have our first child when I finish prelims. Alexander Felicity, but I do hope it's a boy. He's saying, I think I'll take a year off and bartend at my uncle's place in Auckland. So, the ability of a boy to cause more anxiety in the woman's life is just way up there. Okay. So what's the solution to all of this? So what can we do? The young woman, she was stressed out because she read the confessional guide. I read this guide, and it said that looking at your cell phone during a lecture is a sin, and that's crazy. I just can't believe that. Why is that a sin? That shouldn't be a sin. And I said, are you a perfectionist? And she said, yes, I am. I said, look, the just man. Scripture says the just man sins 7 times a day. We have a merciful God. Looking at your cell phone is a sin during a lecture, but it won't send you to hell. Just get over it, right? You can't be perfect. You are going to sin every day, more than you realize. Just realize that. Our worth as human beings comes from the fact that God loves us. And if you read the New Testament, he talks all the time about his love for sinners. He doesn't talk about his love for those who are self-justified and perfect. So just let go of that and just live in that. Your love for who you are because God created you. And so I give a lot of homilies. So somehow... We have to take these students who who seem like their value is based on how successful they can be, either through their looks, their athletic ability, or their intelligence, and that's our culture. Or your value then is also related through relationships, because we can't escape that. We can't escape the fact that we're valued through our relationships. But their value through their relationships isn't based on close-knit family relationships. It's based on more superficial, transitory relationships where my value is based on how you perceive me. And I need you to perceive me in a certain way or you will reject me. And that's exactly what happens in these relationships. You know, family relationships are so awesome. Because when I came home after ordination as a priest, my six brothers and sisters were impressed with that for about 2.5 minutes. After that, I was just Eric, right? And they love me for who I am, which means that means they can criticize me and I can take it. Well, hope, yeah, for the most part, right? You know, we can't get I mean, your family can criticize you too much too. But we know we need those people. I remember I came back to Oshkosh after I went to school for a year, and I went to the parish picnic, and I didn't recognize anybody at the parish picnic. And then all of a sudden I looked across and there's this guy smiling at me with a beer in his hand. It was my Uncle Larry. And it was like, oh wow, here's a guy that knows me and loves me right here. And as soon as I saw that, I just felt more just at home and at peace. You know, because here's this member of my family that knows me and loves me. And we're just missing that in our culture. So what I try to do at St. Paul's is, first of all, understand that, look, you're a sinner. You were a sinner yesterday. You are a sinner today, and you'll be a sinner tomorrow. And God loves you and desires to heal you of your sins. So just chill out about that. You don't have to be perfect to have God's love. Then the second thing that I talk to him is, tell me about your day. When you get up, when you eat, when do you get exercise? When do you pray? And then they tell me their daily schedule. And I think to myself, and sometimes I even say it, if I lived like you, I would be depressed too. Your life's a total mess. Do you need psychological counseling? Do you need professional help? Maybe, but I won't know until you get your life in order. Because half the time, once they get their life in order, their depression and anxiety just goes away. So start getting up at the same time, start praying a little bit, you know, start working out semi-regularly, take time off to be with your friends, you know, just do these things, and you know, let's see what happens to your life. So just order your life. So the other thing that, so at St. Paul's, when I hire new staff, and I hire new staff every year. This year, we had the greatest year ever at St. Paul's. It was just an awesome year. And it was really funny too, because of the 16 people on pastoral staff, only three of them are from the year before. And so most of my pastoral staff are all young people who just graduated. So they're all in their early 20s. And I say, all right, we're going to do a holy hour every morning. I want you there every morning at 8:00. And I say, knees on the kneeler at 8:00. Because I used to work construction. I had this carpenter. Hammer hits the nail at 7:00. You know, you're not putting your tool belt on at 7:00. The hammer hits the nail at 7:00. Your knee. The other thing I tell them too is, I said, look, we have a $1.2 million budget. And we have really generous benefactors that give us a lot of money to sustain this operation. They don't get up at 8:30 in the morning. They get up early and go to work. And we owe it to them to use their money wisely. So I said, you come and pray at 8 o'clock, and we have a holy hour. And I tell them, look, I just want you there at 8. You don't even have to pray. If you want to read the New York Times, read the New York Times. I don't care. Just be there at 8. And then after the holy hour, we have coffee time, where we all have coffee together. And I tell them, this is just not as important as the holy hour, but it's number two. I want you there at the coffee time. Because we need to socialize with each other. We need to be around each other. And I'm telling you, if you pray for an hour and have a good cup of coffee and talk to somebody you like to talk to, that's a great morning. You know, and that'll just set you off in the right direction. So the goal of St. Paul's is to have a happy place where students can really interact with each other and love each other for who they are. I'm going to give you a couple stories about this. So during the pandemic, Father Eric wasn't too crazy about masks. So you guys are all doctors, and I'm one of these people that believe, you know, my great-grandmother on my mom's side said the problem with kids these days is they don't eat enough dirt. And I kind of follow that. So you know when you had to do the hand sanitizer, you know, at Mass? I hate hand sanitizer. I hate it with a passion. And I'd go up there and I'd just put like the smallest little drop on my hands. So anyway, I thought to myself, you know, the emotional well-being of the students here is more important than their physiological health. Their psychological health is more important to me. Because, I mean, I could be wrong. As I read the pandemic, I didn't really, you know, see it doing damage to young people. Now, I could be wrong on that. You know, it could, I mean, that's why I'm totally neutral on the pandemic. I don't think anybody really, it could be, maybe 6 years from now, we find out everybody that got, COVID gets brain cancer at age 62 or something. You know, so, I mean, you don't know what a disease is going to do in a culture until it's been there for a while. So I have great sympathies with people who have different views on this. But my view, and in prayer, and just taking a pot shot at it, is I just put a greater priority on the psychological health of these students than their physiological health. And I had a young man come in. Father, I don't believe in God, and I'm not Catholic. Can I come here? I said, yeah. He said, yeah, I just need to talk to people. And I said, yeah, just come here. It's fine. If anybody gives you a hard time for being an atheist, just let me know. I'll tell them to back off. And 6 months later, he came into my office and he said, Father, I want you to know that when I came in here, I was so depressed. And after 6 months of hanging out at the Student Center, I've never been happier. This is just a happy place. And, you know, he just made friends with people and started talking to people. And, that's what we need to, and that happens a lot. Yeah. Just today a guy came in, he was smiling. He was suicidal. And he just listened to how he's living his life, you know. You know, like, just, all right, just start saying a decade of the rosary every day, go to confession. And he's doing a lot better. You know, he's a lot happier. And he just came and he said, Father, I need a tool. He said, I need a tool. I got a tool from Father Tim. You know, this is because I need a tool. I need another tool to help me, Father. You got to give me another tool. It's going to be this summer, I said. I said, all right, just do this. Just get up every morning this summer at the same time and pray for 10 minutes. That's not a lot of prayer, Father. I can do more than that. I know you can, but it's all about consistency. Get up every morning at 7 o'clock and pray for 10 minutes. And I said, it's kind of like if you're, because the devil will attack you. He'll let you pray 20 hours a day if he knows you'll stop praying for a week. And then he'll attack you. But it's kind of like if you're going to rob a house and you know that guy locked up his house every day really strong, but you know one day out of the month he forgets and leaves the back door open, you wouldn't try to break into that house until he left the back door open, right? He said, yeah, you're right. Wow, I never thought of it that way, Father. This is awesome. This isn't a tool. This is the toolbox. So he's going to go off and go off to that. All right. So another story. So COVID hits, and we all have to go under lockdown. You remember lockdown? We all had to work from home. So I told my whole staff, we're all going to work from home. We're all moving into St. Paul's. So everybody grabbed their mattresses, and the boys moved into the basement where I have a couple showers, and I moved down there with them. And the girls all moved upstairs because there's a couple showers up there, and we turned our classroom into the women's dormitory. And we lived there for like under quarantine, and we had a blast. You know, there was 20 of us living together, and the building is big enough you're not on top of each other all the time. You know, but you know, we had breakfast together, and we had a big flow chart set up for who had to cook and who had to do dishes, and we're having dinner every day. And so a couple years later now, more than one of them have come up to me and said, Father, those are the happiest 5 weeks of my life. You know, how many people can say that quarantine was the happiest 5 weeks of their life, right? Because we were living in community. And all the external pressures, you know, have kind of like gone away, and we're just living in community with each other. So that is the solution. So here's where I get more radical, and we go back to a theological reflection. So we look at our God, and in himself, God is a relationship of love, a Father and a Son and the Holy Spirit. In mutual self-gift, right? In other words, you are, what's more important than what you do is who you are as a person, all right? And you are defined by your relationships with other people. By the way, if anybody's thinking about being a priest, that's the greatest thing about being a priest. Priests are happy men because they live in relationships with a lot of people. I tell people, when a priest shows up in a new parish, everybody there wants to like you. You know, that's a pretty good situation. Now, you can ruin that pretty quick, you know, but at least when you get there. So, but if you look at God, so God's perfectly happy within himself. He's perfectly happy. But he doesn't just keep that joy and happiness to himself. He creates other persons to share in his joy and happiness. And so as human beings, we're meant to create. We're not meant to consume, which is another problem with our culture, because our culture is based on consumption. To make money in order to consume more things. I've done some research on that. This is why the 13th century is the greatest of all centuries. It really is. You know, by the way, modern medicine started in the 13th century. Surgery, all this stuff started in the 13th century. There's a man who won a Nobel Peace Prize because he was reading something a doctor was doing in the 13th century. And he brought it, so it's just crazy. These towns built these cathedrals. Towns of 5,000 people built these cathedrals. Okay? In order to hang out your shingle and say that you were a, let's say, a cabinet maker, or let's say you were a blacksmith. You first obviously had to be an apprentice, right? And then after you're an apprentice, you're a journeyman. And you journeyed around to other men learning how to be a blacksmith. And then after you did that for 7 years, you would create something, and you would bring it to the guild, and the guild would look at it, and if it was sufficiently well built, they made you a master blacksmith. So that was your masterpiece after 7 years, and you were a craftsman. And you're being, you know, you're creating something beautiful. That's why the 13th century is all about Everything you make should be beautiful. That's why hinges were just gorgeous, because they're making them to be beautiful, to be a reflection of God's divinity. But then when the industrial age came along, the industrial age broke that system because they needed people to mass produce things quickly in order to maximize profit and consumption. And they wanted these men, and there was a big battle between the guilds and the industrialists, and obviously the guilds lost and the industrialists won. So now we have massive amounts of things made for us that we throw away regularly, and nobody takes, there's no joy in just making things. And most men, young men, want to make stuff more than they want to sit at a computer and code, you know. That's why God gave us a thumb, you know, so we could make things. So anyway, God creates. So what's the most beautiful thing that you can create? The most beautiful thing that you can create is a baby. There's nothing more beautiful than a baby. And who creates babies? Women do, because women have wombs, which is just an amazing, amazing thing. And it's taken me a long time. You know, when first I started talking about this at St. Paul's, they thought, well, you say I just have to be a mother. I'm like, no, if you want to be a doctor, be a doctor. I mean, most surgeons should probably be women, you know. They're better with their hands than men are, you know. So we need. In fact, I know this. I just had dinner with a friend of mine, and her daughter is in her rotations, and she wants to be a mom, and she did her surgery rotation, and the doctor said, you know, do you know how to suture? She said, yeah, I practiced it on the board. And he said, can you just do a suture on this patient? And she did it, and it said, suture the whole patient. And he looked at her and said, you are amazing. If you just did that, I said, who taught you how to suture? She said, I taught myself. She said, you have a knack for this. You should be a surgeon. And she's like, I don't want to do a residency of 90 hours a week, right? You know, so maybe we need to change the whole way we do residency so a woman like that could be a surgeon, you know, and maybe still be a mom. So anyway, back to motherhood. Motherhood is the most, and we've gotten away from this, which is why we're unhappy. Motherhood is the most amazing job there is in the world. Nothing comes close to motherhood. Nothing. There's mom, then there's dad. Dad's important. They push back on that. Well, dad's just as important as mom. And I'm like, no, he's not. For the first 9 months of your life, dad could do whatever he wanted. You didn't care. But if mom died, you were dead. Right? Those 9 months in the womb are crucial, right? And I hear funny things, you know, like this man told me at marriage prep, we're going to change child rearing. We're going to share it 50-50. I'm like, that's great if you can nurse. That'd be awesome. You know, figure that out. So, but on the flip side of that is, so I think our dignity as persons, so our dignity as a person is more important than our dignity as a male person or as a female person, okay? So as persons, you know, we have equal dignity, and, you know, we're persons in a certain sense. We're persons with intellect and will before I'm a female or a male, okay? So you don't want to get too tied up in this. But at the same time, you can only be a person as a male or as a female. So there are differences that need to be understood and respected. One of the biggest differences is that women become moms and men don't. And just look at, you know, we've been talking about family, and you're going to have to edit this part out here, but I've been thinking about mom and the family, because everybody says, you know, if mom ain't happy, ain't nobody happy, right? I remember that. You know, if dad wasn't happy, we just kind of ignored him. Mom isn't happy, you're like. And I was reflecting on this on a woman's body, because now women don't have greater dignity than men do, but in a certain sense their bodies do, because from their bodies come life. And if you think about a woman, In a family of, let's say there's five kids, so it's a family of seven. She's the most important person in those six people's lives. All those kids and the husband all look to her as the person that they esteem and love, know and want the most. What a very privileged place to be. Now you can experience that obviously as a great burden, but it's a very privileged place to be. And not only that, but they all want your body. You know, there's a kid growing inside your body. There's a kid that wants to latch onto your body and eat. You know, there's little kids there that just want to hang on your body. Dad comes home, he wants in. You know, everybody wants a piece of that. Which I think, to tell you the truth, is why women by instinct take better care of their bodies. I think by instinct women take better care of their bodies, not for themselves, but because they realize their body is a gift to the family that, you know, everybody needs, right? And so a woman's got to realize this. So on the flip side, okay, women have bodies, so what do men, I mean, and give birth, so what do men do? You know what I mean? What's my use in life? Because you need to feel like you're needed. You need a place in culture. You need a place in the world. So what's my place in the world? And we're telling women right now that their place in the world is not being moms. Their place is to have a career. So they're so career driven. And you don't have, but and let me just explain this a little bit. If you grow up in a farm culture, you might be the school teacher's kid. But because you grew up in a farm culture, you think and act like a farmer, even though you weren't on a farm, because you grew up with farmers, you know. Yeah. And so what I'm saying is what we need, it doesn't mean that every woman has to have a baby in order to feel her dignity. But if we elevated motherhood, all women, because of that, would just inherently feel their dignity and purpose. Because every woman is a mom, whether she has a baby or not. Every woman mothers, right? That's what you do as a woman, you mother. And every man is meant to father. So we find our purpose and dignity in being fathers. And so, but right now, we're telling women, we don't need your motherhood, we need you in the world. And we're telling boys, we don't need your fatherhood. We don't even need you at all. You're toxic, right? That's what we're telling boys, we're toxic. And so, what's their purpose? Their purpose is to just watch ESPN and, you know, more and more, you know, masturbate and watch pornography. Because, you know, the world doesn't need them. So that's kind of where we are right now. So you can't elevate fatherhood unless you first elevate motherhood. Because when you elevate motherhood, it's like, okay, you need to help this woman be the mother she needs to be, because that's the father's responsibility, to help her to be the mother she needs to be. And it's, again, marriage prep. I'm sitting there and this young woman looks at me and I go, well, when are you going to have children? And it's like 7 years down the road, because she's got this career path she wants to follow first. And I'm like, why do you need that career so, you know, why is that so important to you? Well, I need to make money to support our family. And I'm like, well, what's this guy for? You know? And you can't get away from the fact that, you know, the man can't have the baby. He can't nurse the baby. He's not going to be nearly as good with the baby. And so you got to give, you know, men a role. So anyway, the last thing, and I'm telling this to students all the time, just so they can realize that our purpose as human beings is not to enter into this highly industrialized world and have this great career. I mean, and I'm telling them, have a career. There's nothing wrong with a career. Have it. But don't make that the goal of your life. The goal of your life is to live in a relationship with other people, ideally in a family or attached to a family. That's the goal of life. You know, especially why... You look at something as, like, I'm getting a master's in accounting. And I'm like, a master's in accounting, which is great. You want to be an accountant? Be an accountant. You're spending so much time learning tax code. How irrelevant is tax code to the meaning of life? Tomorrow, right? What's relevant is literature and art and music and good food and learning the difference between, you know, a Pinot Grigio and a Cabernet. You know, that's, you know, that's what makes life, you know, more interesting and more meaningful, and, you know, being able to share that with people. The other thing I tell that's my students all the time, I said, look, importance of jobs in a community. Mom's number one, then comes dad, then comes teacher. Those are the three most important jobs. If you get those three right, after teacher comes garbage collector. You want to do something important? Pick up garbage. I'd rather live in a city without brain surgeons than without garbage collectors. You know, cleaning is such a beautiful thing to do. I spend my whole life cleaning because I live in a house with 10 college kids. I'm constantly cleaning. My student center is a constant mess. I'm constantly cleaning. The highlight of my whole year is when I take all the staff and say, this is my favorite day of the year. And then what's that? I give them all scrub brushes. We're going to scrub the grout in the floors. And we do that for the, you know, cleaning's a beautiful thing. I want to hire a cleaning lady full time, Suyapa, because we have a service. And I don't like services because you don't have to give them benefits now. You just give it to the service. And everybody that works for you should have the same benefits, right? And so I want to hire her full time and give her benefits. But, you know, every time I approach her with hiring, she gets nervous because I'm sure she's illegal, you know. So anyway, that's my talk. I guess I've gone 45 minutes. Do we have any questions? Yep.
Okay, you know what I'll do? Let me get the other mic and all right. We'll... Okay. Oh. There we go. Okay, yeah, there we go. Okay, so there are a lot of good questions, and I'm gonna kind of group them so that you can answer a couple things at once. Okay, so, how does anxiety differ in young men versus young women, and how do you counsel them differently?
My experience has been the anxiety with young women is they're the ones who are really geared towards perfectionism. And there's somehow their self-identity is set up on having complete control of the world that they live in. Women are orientated towards control. And it makes sense because you want a baby to grow up in a controlled environment, right? And so they get really nervous about that. I was counseling one young woman and I said, all right, you know, they come to me with, what's your grade point? 4.0, all right. What's your next quiz? Okay, it's in biology. All right. Why don't you get a B on that quiz? This is the honest to God response. Father, let's not move so fast. So I actually counsel them just to let go of something. Like this class over here, just study for that class only an hour a week. And take whatever grade you're going to get from that. See, I'm more of a psychologist than a priest, right? God doesn't care what grade you get on that. You know, because you can put it in perspective, like sin, I skipped a class. I said, well, it's not a sin necessarily to skip a class. What did you do when you skipped class? Did you skip a class so you could go take your mom to the hospital? You know, did you skip a class to have coffee with a friend who was having a hard time? You know, was that a very important class? What are you going to be? You know, well, I plan to be a doctor. Well, then go to that class, you know. But with the boys' anxiety tends to be, because most of the boys are not that anxious. They're just not amounting to anything.
What do you got against us?
So they are. It's just taking a while. It's so funny. I had this girl got I'm in love with this boy. This boy is great. I really love this boy. And she, this girl, it's the same thing. This boy is totally laid back, and this girl is like, she's totally dialed in. And they got engaged their sophomore year, which I thought was awesome, you know? And she's breaking off the engagement. She's in, they're in front of me. I'm gonna break off the engagement. And she's like, well, why? Well, you know, he's just kind of immature. And I'm like, well, actually, for a sophomore in college, he's doing pretty good, you know? I said, your dad was probably, you know, you're not, these, it takes a while for guys to grow up, you know? He's gonna be great at 28. Now he's only 21, he's only 20, you know, take his time. So with the guys that are suffering from, and I don't experience anxiety with the guys as much as I experience depression. You know, it's, they're depressed. And they're depressed because they have, the world isn't telling them that the world needs them, you know? And they see themselves failing and not measuring up to the people around them. And they're addicted to usually pornography. And so what you have to really do is you have to just really build up their self-esteem that they're fine. You're a good man. You're not evil. You are going to do a lot of good things in the world. And the world needs you. The world needs you, and you'll have the capacity of doing great things. So just trust yourself. So, yeah. The last boy I told that to, he looked at me and he said, Father, I don't believe that. But I believe you. So I'll trust you, he said. I'll trust you. So that's what you have to do with the boys. You got to tell the boys. And this is where the girls, this is why it's so messed up, because we're telling the girls, you got to figure it all out and do it all on your own. Which means the boys don't feel needed. You know, here's a little story I'll tell you. I was dating this girl. They say, well, the world shouldn't be like this. Girls will tell me that. Well, boys shouldn't be like that. Maybe they shouldn't, but I'm telling you, honey, that's the way they are. You can either live in reality or not. So I was walking down the street with this girl I was going out with. And I was thinking, all right, this is it. This is the last date. I'm not going out with her anymore. So we're walking down State Street. We're crossing the street. And this bike goes by super fast. And she gets scared, jumps behind me, and grabs my arm. As soon as she did that, the first thought in my mind was, I'm going to keep going out with this girl. Because she needed me, you know, she built up my esteem as a man, right? And suddenly I was needed. And that's what we got to do to these boys. We got to tell them that they're needed. And you just can't, well, I need you to be emotionally present to me. Well, that doesn't do that for guys, right? You know? All right, next question.
Okay. These both have to do with what can parents do as they're raising their children. So what changes should parents make to help alleviate these problems for their children? Is there a contributing factor related to parents trying to optimize their children and their lives?
Yeah, so my father was a very interesting man, as my aunt can attest to. Gave us complete freedom in our life, probably a little bit too much. So I'm not saying you shouldn't try to help your children, you know, move in the right direction. But you got to give your children a lot of freedom to make their own choices and do their own thing and make their own mistakes. And you have to give them the feeling that the only thing we want from them is just to be good people. I would rather have you, you know, being loving and kind than successful. And so it's not, again, it's not that the career and the making money is a bad thing. It's just that we've made that the most important thing in life, and that has to be flipped back over. Or the most important thing in life is just being in a relationship with other people and that family meal, you know. So you can do this even in high school. You know, well, the coach says if I don't go, I won't play. And college sports is a good thing. I mean, high school sports is a good thing. But I thought as a father, I might say, well, look, you know, it's your sister's birthday. And when your wife is on bed rest, your football coach ain't going to be bringing over soup and salad. Your sister is. So you're going to be here because it's important to your sister. And so just to kind of reinforce that as a family and tell your kid, look, I don't care what you do. You know, be a truck driver if that's what makes you happy. I think you could do a lot better, son, you know. But if we want to be a truck driver, be a truck driver. We need truck drivers. That's the other thing that I don't like about our culture. Our culture says, you know, whenever we talk about being, success is always going to college. We're all college educated here. If you have to go to college to be have a happy, successful life, we live in a very sad world. That's a very sad world. So go to college if you want to go to college, but do whatever it is that you want. So I think to take pressure off of them, to think that they have to do a specific thing in order to be happy. So that's what I would do. I mean, that's the way my family grew up. We're all pretty happy. And most of us went to college, actually.
These are related questions about modeling the love and mercy of God in our lives. One person said, I love your message about being loved for who we are and not what we do. First of all, how do we share this message with the world, but also while not dismissing the essential nature of morality? So how do we show mercy but not dismiss morality?
Yeah, because... Yeah, the thing is that this is going to be very hard. I don't know how we engage the secular world, to tell you the truth. How many were you at that Milwaukee talk? Or the, what was that? What was that called? The Pallium Lecture. Yeah, he gave a great talk. And then I asked him this question. And it was a talk about how we need to engage the world with, you know, the truth and the Constitution. And I said, how do you do that in a world that doesn't believe in truth? And he said, well, you have to evangelize, which is, well, if they're all Christians, we wouldn't be having this problem right now, right? So the best book I've read recently, and it was so good, before I even finished it, I started it over again. Alistair MacIntyre, After Virtue. After Virtue. It's not an easy read. You're going to be Googling all sorts of philosophical ideas and political ideas. But if you read that book, you realize it's over. In other words, the ability to intellectually engage the world we live in is almost impossible because we're just on two totally different philosophical mindsets. I'm not saying it's over. I'm saying you should still be engaged in the world and, you know, run for political office and do what you can. I'm not saying we should just retreat. I'm saying you just have to realize to engage people in these ideas is really extremely difficult. I think the only thing you can do is on a personal level, just love people. You know, just love people on a personal level and just be interested in them and be happy for them when they succeed and be willing to be in that conversation with that neighbor where all she can talk about is herself. You gotta have at least one person like that in your life. Okay, and just, I think that's our hope. We just have to be a witness of love to other people. And we do that at St. Paul's all the time. I'm always telling my staff, you always have to have that one person who's your friend who just, they don't know how to be a friend. And you just have to be a friend of that person.
How do you help students who hold grudges against parents? And this person is asking about the work of a UW faculty member, Robert Enright, on forgiveness.
Yeah, so Bob Enright is a friend of mine. I met him a long time ago and he's got a great institute going there. You can read that. When students come to me mad at their parents, and I have a new philosophy, I try not to hire anybody who is angry with their dad because they'll eventually be angry with me. So, and I say, look, you have to be at peace with who your parents are. You don't have to necessarily think they're great people. You don't have to make them your best friends, but you have to forgive them and you have to be at peace with them. Because if you don't forgive your parents and be at peace with them, you will never be at peace yourself. You have to come to grips with who your parents are and forgive them. And they were probably better than you realize. There's different scenarios too in that, you know, that's, you know, sometimes people just had unbelievable high expectations of who their parents are supposed to be that they got to let go of. And sometimes they just really had crappy parents. But to tell you the truth, the ones with the crappy parents do easier forgiving them than the ones that had idealized expectations and have some, you know. But you just have to say, for your benefit, you have to let go of this. And if you turn to Jesus and ask him to give you the grace to forgive your parents, he will give you that grace.
There were a couple of questions about students at elite universities versus others, and also a specific question about UW. Do you think students feel stress because of the left-wing teaching they get from UW? So first of all, about elite versus not elite.
Yeah. Yeah, so the second question is a little easier. Do they feel stressed by it? I don't think they feel stressed by it at all. I mean, sometimes they do. Like I had a woman, you know, sometimes they're in some program, if they find out that they think that homosexual acts are a sin, they'll get kicked out. That's kind of stressful. But for the most part, they roll with it. What's difficult is the ideas they assimilate in their heads that make life more stressful for them, not the actual, I think. And so that's the problem. That's the problem there. But for the most part, the students see it, they recognize it, and then they come back to St. Paul's and laugh about it. Yeah, there's some crazy stuff out there. But the great thing about it, it's gone so crazy, it's so easy to recognize, you know? So elite versus non-elite. So my, UW-Madison's more elite, so that's my experience. So I don't have that much of experience at UW-Oshkosh. So I think at these lower colleges, the expectations aren't so high, so the stress isn't quite so high. That'd just be my assumption and what I get from talking to my other fellow priests at like Platteville and Oshkosh. The drinking is a lot worse at Oshkosh than it is at Wisconsin, because at Wisconsin you've got to compete and you've got to study, so you can't be drinking all the time. Where at Oshkosh, you can probably drink all the time and still pass, right? Yeah, I know that a guy that went to White, it's just the way it is, it went to Whitewater, he transferred to Whitewater, he called me up and said, yeah, Father, I got an A on this exam. At Wisconsin, would have been a C minus. So there is a higher, you know, it is a stronger school.
So I hope I'm understanding this question correctly. What is the failure rate of spiritual counseling? And I'm not sure, I mean, that does bring up the question of what about after spiritual counseling? If there's, you know, if there's more to it than that. I don't know if that's what the person was asking. Anyway.
Yeah. So here, the way it works with me is somebody comes to me, and most of my spiritual counseling in the beginning isn't really spiritual direction. It's just getting to live a well-ordered life, right? And a lot of times, if that doesn't heal a person, then they need psychological counseling. Then they've got some wound within them that just needs to be addressed by somebody who's a counselor, because I'm not a counselor, right? So that's my first tact. And if they do that, and then if they start living a regular spiritual life, and then you see growth. What percentage of students that I see do that, you know, who come to me? Probably, I would say 30%, you know, because it's hard to persevere. Most people, it's like, you know, you improve until you've improved kind of good enough and you feel okay, and then it's kind of like exercise, you know, it's like, how many of you have done PT, right? Physical therapy. They say do this for 6 months, you do it for four, I feel okay now, right? And then you stop. And people kind of take that same approach to the spiritual life sometimes, which is why just get everybody to pray the rosary every day. So that's it. One more.
What about just in general, you talked a little bit about this, but just overall at the university, how do you think COVID, the whole COVID situation, has affected student life, relationships, and faith sharing on the campus?
That's hard for me to judge because at Wisconsin, we just kind of kept doing our thing. So the students that came to St. Paul's and kept coming to St. Paul's, they made friends, they kept their friends, life went on. And I tell students this at the beginning of the year, I say, look, your academics is important, but the friendships you form in college are just as important. And so it could be that we have a whole group of students, especially that, because you make a lot of your friends freshman, sophomore year. If your freshman, sophomore year is your COVID year, they just missed out on making those college friends that, you know, and they just missed out on that good experience. So here's the thing too about college, and that is Winston Churchill said this, the thing that you do in your late teens and early 20s just always remains the most happy and exciting time of your life. And there's something about that. And so that's the unique thing about college. It should be just a very happy, exciting time in your life. It shouldn't be this. And this is why this talk gets me, because there's always stress, and there's always anxiety, and there's always people who are suffering from anxiety. But college shouldn't be that anxious an anxious time for the vast majority of kids. It should just be a very happy, more or less carefree time. It was for me when I went to college. That's why I love college. I cried when I graduated. Anyway, I think COVID robbed a generation of, or two years of kids from having that.
Yeah, if I could, I want to ask you one more thing about social media too, but if I could just make a comment as a psychiatrist, and I think a lot of people are aware of this, that rates of anxiety and depression during COVID increased substantially for the general population, but the age groups that were most affected were college students and the elderly, and you can kind of figure out why. I mean, what you talked about living in community versus being socially isolated, that is extremely, it has so much value to people at those two times of life, yeah. Especially college. But I wanted to ask you about social media. Women and men, college men, college women, social media, and how that, what your observations are about anxiety and depression related to social media use.
Social media is, the more you're on studies have shown this, the more you're on Facebook, the more depressed you are. Because when you're on Facebook, you're looking at everybody having a good time, because that's what they put on Facebook, right? And you're not having a good time, or you wouldn't be on Facebook, right? So you're just setting yourself up to be more depressed, you know, as soon as you get on there. The problem with social media with boys is they just go to images right away that don't help them. So that's the problem with the boys. They're not on social media the way the girls are. The boys are on there and then they get caught up in the imagery and that hurts them. And masturbation just really hurts boys, you know, and pornography really hurts them. It robs them of their confidence. We were trying to get, you know, for Lent, I'm off of Facebook, and they're like, wow, it's just really, there's no reason to go on. You go on Facebook the way you go into a bad neighborhood. You go there, get what you want, and you get out of there. That's what Facebook should be. And here's another thing. We saw a dramatic change in the student body when the first students came to St. Paul's that got cell phones as in their early teens. That really hurt them. It really hurt their ability to socialize. And we had to adapt our whole outreach on a different level because they just didn't socialize as well. I would not give a kid a cell phone until they're 16. Or if you had to give them a flip phone, you know, if you want them to have a phone.
Okay. That's actually about it for the written questions that we have. Do you have any other final comments that you'd like to make, Father Eric? Or we've got just a couple of minutes.
Just a couple minutes. So if you want to change the world and make the world a better place, first of all, here's the thing is, stay united to your bishop. Don't criticize the Pope. It's not going to get you anywhere. He's saying a lot of good stuff. The stuff you don't quite understand, don't read that stuff. Read the good stuff. Learn how to pray. We have to be a people who know how to pray. We have to be a people who know how to have a heart-to-heart conversation with Jesus Christ. That requires the ability to spend 20 minutes every day not reading a book, not journaling, but opening your heart up to Jesus, talking to Him from your heart and listening to Him. In order to do that, it's just been my experience over 16 years. It helps if you've really disciplined yourself to pray the rosary every day. So I would start by praying the rosary every day and really meditate on the mysteries and then build up to doing 20 minutes of mental prayer. And then forget about money. I used to think the number one problem in our culture was our addiction to sex. But now, whether it's my greater wisdom or lack of libido, I've changed my mind. It really is the love of money. The love of money is killing the world. All of our evil comes from the love of money. I'll give you one example. I went to a talk on transgenderism and what do they call that? Gender transitioning. Gender transitioning is all the rage in the United States, right? We're transitioning all these kids. It's banned in most countries of Europe. You can't do it in Europe. You know why you can't do it in Europe and you can do it in the United States? Because in Europe, the insurance doesn't pay for it. Here it does. So there's money to be made. And so it's promoted by people that want to make money off of it. And there's hundreds of examples of that. So first, become a person of prayer. And then secondly, let go of your desire for wealth as a measure of who you are as a person and what you think you need in order to be happy. As Christians, we need to be simple people who are happy with who we have, with what we have. And if the career you pick ends up making you a lot of money, that's awesome. You can give a lot of it to me, and I can run my spirit, you know? So in other words, there's nothing. And then the other thing, if I could say, just be very local. Let me back up. I really wanted to say this. We need to support moms. Our culture does not support motherhood. It is really hard to be a happy mother right now. Because you're a mom, you're in this house, you have your three kids, because Father Eric told you not to use contraception. So there you are with your three babies. Your husband goes to work and you want to be the stay-at-home mom and you were working as an attorney and now you're with these three kids. They are black holes of affection. They cannot carry a conversation, and you used to be the best attorney in your office. And now you're sitting here, and I had a mother tell me once, I'm more alone with my kids than I am by myself, because when I'm by myself, at least I can have my own thoughts. When I'm with the kids, it's like, here, truckie, 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 you know. So there this poor woman is, she's home by herself with these kids, and then her husband comes home, and she's so excited to talk to her husband. When a man comes home from work, what does he want to do? He wants to go in the basement, have a beer, and talk to nobody. So now you have two people meeting with very legitimate, diametrically opposed needs. As I tell the girls now, in the 50s, in the Triangle, which is this old, run-down, poor Italian neighborhood in Madison that they destroyed in the 60s, you're 19 years old. You came home with your 21, or you came home with your baby. You're 19, because that's what he did in the 40s and 50s. He got married at 19. Your 21-year-old husband, where was he? He was at the bar smoking a cigar, bragging about the baby he had, right? You're home. But who are you with? You know, your grandma comes over. Your cousin next door comes over. The 12-year-old girl across the street is excited. She's over there. You're in this community of people that are supporting you. The home is where our life should be. Nobody eats at home anymore. We all eat at McDonald's. I say the microwave has replaced the woman. You know, I don't need my wife anymore because I got a microwave. And we've got to somehow, I tell men that are getting married, it's worth a $30,000 a year pay cut for you to move your wife next door to her best friend or her favorite sister. So the communities, this is really developing now. Catholics, our young families are moving closer together and forming these types of communities. Here's the other thing too about this. We're made for relationships. In the old days, a mom would put a little kid and she'd go to the hardware store and she would talk to the man selling her, you know, whatever that she, the screwdriver she needed to fix something because her husband wouldn't do it, right? So she's buying the screwdriver and she's talking to this guy. And this guy is married to her cousin, you know, and she talks to him. It's a relationship. And so here's the last thing I'll leave you with. You can never treat a human person as a means of use. So when you go to the checkout counter and you look at that person checking out your groceries, before that person is checking out your groceries, that's a human person that you're supposed to relate to as a human person. It's not somebody you're just supposed to use to give you your groceries. So whoever that person is, the guy shingling your roof, whatever human being you meet, you have to first relate to them as a human person. And it's so sad now because when I go to the checkout counter and there's a student behind there and I try to relate to him as a human person, they get scared. What are you doing talking to me? Just get your groceries and get out of here, you know. So pray, let go of your desire for wealth, treat people as human persons, and let's do all we can do to make staying at home and raising children a beautiful, happy experience. And let's try to pay people so that if you're a roofer, it's a good job. You know, I don't have to go to college in order to make money. I can actually just, you know, work and do the normal things that other people do. So anyway, that's my final words.